Well, 2 weeks ago, we started looking at the high priestly prayer of Jesus in John chapter 17. And it began with a concern for bringing glory to God. And that was to be accomplished by Christ's work on the cross. And that's what he was anticipating. And so he was asking that he would be glorified as he accomplished what was just a short time away from being accomplished. But it still meant a willingness on his part. And as you recall, in between the time of the high priestly prayer and the actual crucifixion was the Garden of Gethsemane experience where he was praying to the Father and said, "Lord, if it be your will, take this from me so I don't have to deal with this," realizing the weight of what he was facing, but he pressed on. But then, in the high priestly prayer in John chapter 17, there's a change of focus from the future divine glory that was awaiting Christ as he was going to bring to conclusion the work that he came to do, a movement from thinking about the future and that divine glory to the present human reality that was awaiting the disciples. And so that was going to be the change. And considering the number of verses that are given over to this second topic, it seems that the concerns for Jesus' disciples was going to be almost a stronger weight of concern than what it was on his mind regarding what he was going to be facing himself. And so there's a dual element here. And what's interesting to think about is the matter of greatest importance had to do with Jesus accomplishing his task. That was the biggest thing. And yet the more urgent thing was what the disciples were going to be facing. And his concern was divided between those two things. And it's interesting that we have similar kinds of things. There is often a need to balance the critical or the important with the urgent or the pressing. And Jesus had a way of being able to deal with both and to keep them in right perspective. And sometimes we can and sometimes we don't do quite so well. Because just as a for instance, one of the things that we know is critically important is our daily quiet time with the Lord, spending time with him. That's important. But what edges that out? The urgent, the things that come along that just don't have time. What's important and what's urgent? And can we keep those things in the right balance? The disciples and the future were clearly on his mind. He was looking forward to what was going to happen as it related to him bringing his work to completion, but also with regard to his disciples and what was going to happen to them in just the few hours that were going to be taking place just ahead, or in the long term, what was going to happen with them. And what were some of the things that were on his mind? Well, he knew what they were like. Did he have any reason to be concerned? They were some characters, kind of like us. And the Lord's got to deal with us as well. He knew their abilities, but he also knew their deficiencies. And he knew what they would be facing. He understood what was going to be taking place. He had warned them of the opposition and persecution and all the obstacles that they were going to be facing. And he also knew what he was entrusting to them. He was going to be leaving, and he was leaving everything in their hands. There was maybe good reason for him to be concerned. He was delegating the work to them. And they were a fine bunch. And at this time, and what was going to be taking place just in the next few hours, I'm sure he could easily have been a little discouraged, thinking, there is no way this thing's going to get off the ground with these guys. First of all, they run. And then there's the denial. And then they just don't know what to do. He was investing a great deal in them. And he had great expectations. So he had reason to be concerned. So we want to think about what were his concerns for them as he's going to be communicating in this passage. So the first concern is relational, relating to God, relating to the world, relating to Christ himself. And we have the text, I have manifested your name to the men whom you have given me out of the world. They were yours. You gave them to me, and they have kept your word. Now, there's a sense in which you could say, when he says, you gave them to me, and he says, and you gave me quite a bunch here. Now, they have known that all things which you have given me are from you. So he's acknowledging that they see a connection between the Father and the Son. Verse 8, for I have given to them the words which you have given me, and they have received them, and have known surely that I came forth from you, and they have believed that you sent me. You see all the relational elements that are part of this picture here, and then all the uses of the word given or give in the passage as well. Interesting things to note. So what do we want to think about? Here, the divine perspective puts us in our place. Do we need to be put in our place? Well, probably frequently. One of the things that are communicated here is that we are God's possessions. And this, again, is looking at from the divine perspective, but also from reality. The reality is we are his, and he can do with us what he wants. But we tend to think that we are our own possessions, and all of our stuff is ours. We just think that way. And don't anybody mess with my stuff, or don't anybody mess with me. Because I'm in control, or so we think. We think we're in control of our own destiny. But there's a difference between our perspective and God's perspective. We think that we choose him, and he says that he chooses us. The disciples thought that they chose to follow Christ, and Christ did say, follow me, and they did. And yet, there's another element that God says, hey, I'm driving this thing. They were mine. I gave them to you. Interesting to think about. How do we put all that together? Well, we need to try to remember. What is it? What does it look like from our perspective? What does it look like from God's perspective? And can our contribution to the picture function without in any way undermining what God's involvement in the picture includes? So God is ultimately in control, but we have a part in the equation. And our problem is we can't see exactly how they all fit together. Partly because we can't see how God works. And we shouldn't expect to, because he's not of the same stuff that we are. But it does indicate that there was a sovereign plan in place and that God had an order of things that he was working in to come to pass. And Christ has given us greater insight into God's nature, as he did with the disciples, because Christ has manifested God to men, made known to them. That's part of what we see there. And you recall John 1:18 says, no one has seen God at any time. The only begotten who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him. We can't get a perfectly clear glimpse of God. We just aren't able to do that because he is above and beyond us. But we can see something of him through Christ, who did become man and died in our place. And therefore, that's what we need to recognize. So he communicated God to us more directly so that we could have an understanding of him. And the disciples recognized that Christ was from God, and that's communicated more than once. And, I mean, just reading through John chapter 6, the bread of life discourse, you see the number of times that he indicates that he came from heaven, and he's going back there. And that was referenced many times throughout the scriptures and in the Gospels in particular, and as we have seen even in the book of John in particular. And the disciples believed, it says, that the Father had sent him to the earth. And so he consistently and frequently emphasized his relationship with the Father and his purpose in speaking and doing what the Father had given him to say and do. And that should be clear. And so he's acknowledging his relationship with the Father and his relationship with the disciples in terms of their responsiveness to him. Even though the disciples didn't understand all that Jesus had communicated with them from the Father, but they did come to accept that he came from the Father, that he was, in fact, the Messiah, the Son of God. So they were catching on to some things. The human perspective is enhanced by divine input. And that's something that's helpful for us to keep in mind. We can look around us. We can see that there is evidence of someone, something that accounts for all that is, but we need the divine input, divine revelation. Because even though there are some things we can see by natural revelation, Romans chapter 1 reminds us of this, as does Psalm 19. So the disciples were given truth about Christ and the Father so that they had greater insight than just looking at the world around them. And we know that this had been communicated by the prophets and then through Christ, Hebrews 1, verses 1 through 3. And this is a text that I think is helpful to recognize in terms of the perspective of the Jewish thinking at this time from those who were believers, as the writer of Hebrews tells us. God, who at various times and in various ways spoke in time past to the fathers by the prophets. That's recognizing the Old Testament provision of revelation, has in these last days spoken to us by his Son. So there is a communication through the written word as well as through the living word, whom he has appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the worlds, who being in the brightness of his glory and the express image of his person and upholding all things by the word of his power, when he had by himself purged our sins, sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. And that's just giving us a glimpse of who is this one who came as the special revelation, the revealer of God and his truth. So they knew who the Father was from Old Testament teaching, and so they had a picture there, but then the Son came and gave greater revelation, and we stand on their shoulders looking back over a greater amount of history, so we should have a bigger, clearer picture of who God is in light of that, and as part of what's communicated here. And yet, even though they were as close as they were to Christ, they still didn't understand it all. They still weren't able to put it all together. And the church would take some time in trying to even figure out all of the details of who Christ was. I mean, the hypostatic union took another roughly 400 years before they figured that out. Who on earth is Jesus? What was he? Was he fully God? Was he fully man? How did that fit together? And there are still people today who don't really have a clue as to how that fits together. The disciples kept the word that they were given. Now, I think back when I read through that text, it's almost as if Jesus is trying to convince the Father that these guys really are going to work out. I mean, you just look back over that text. It's like Jesus saying, "No, I think they're gonna pull it off. It's gonna be okay. Just relax. I know it looks like they're a total mess, but I think they're gonna do it." That's what it really does sound like. So he says they kept the word. They took to heart what had been stated. They didn't catch it all. They didn't understand. They couldn't put it all together. But yet, they were catching enough. And that ought to be some encouragement to us. There are things where we are told that we need to accept by the faith of a child of what God's provisions are, particularly as it relates to what Christ has done for us. But then there's also text that tells us, study to show yourself approved. So there's an element of simple faith, and there's an element of study to understand and put it all together. And we need to have a proper balance of those things. One of them is focused on our heart response, which is essential, and the other is focused on our head understanding and application of truth to life. And we're all in the process of trying to make sense of that as well. I mean, every time we think about Scripture, we think about the details of life and how to function in this world, we have to come back to try to make some sense of how does this truth, biblical truth, apply to real life. And we were talking about that in our Sunday school time. We were talking about just the idea of marriage. What exactly constitutes marriage in light of looking at Genesis chapter 1 and chapter 2 ultimately? We want to try to understand those things, apply that to life, especially in the context where things are so confused. So, properly applying truth. So, the first concern is relational, and the second concern is behavioral. And you'll notice that I broke up the text a little bit to look at these things because the earlier verses 6 through 8 and then verses 17 through 19 relate more to the keeping of his word or truth, and his word is truth. And so I'm putting those together, and then we'll come back next time. We'll focus more on their relationship to the world. Now we're focusing on their relationship to the word, to the truth. And that's what this is going to be looking at. When we think about behavioral, it has to do with the idea of their relationship to the truth. And that has to do with, are you living out that reality? And so it says in verse 17 through 19, sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. As you have sent me into the world, I also have sent them into the world. And for their sakes, I sanctify myself, that they also may be sanctified by the truth. Whatever sanctified means. And that's probably going to be an important thing to think about. Behavioral expectations do not work in a vacuum. When we tell a child to behave in a certain way, we have a context in mind. And there is an element of the truth that they are hearing is coming from somebody who is thinking about in relation to a particular context. I think back to when our kids were young and we would be anticipating going somewhere, wherever it may be, we would tell our kids prior to going, this is our expectation of you. This is what we want you to do. If you see somebody that you don't know, you need to talk to them and address them and be responsive, and you need to behave yourself in a certain way. We would remind them so that they would get used to the idea of where every place has a behavioral expectation and there's a context, and these are expected of me, so that the time would come when we wouldn't have to tell them and they would just naturally do it. And now our kids are just wonderful. Stacy's smiling back there for some reason. No bias. The parameters of personal behavior are set by biblical truth. That's what's being indicated here. Sanctify them by their truth. Set apart by truth. Your word is truth. That's to be the guiding principle. Every context in life involves the application of biblical truth. And our situations vary, but the truth doesn't. Its application may, according to where we are. So again, remembering that to sanctify means to set apart for God's service, to be set apart from something to something. And just a couple of examples of how the word is used in other contexts. In Exodus 28:41, it says, "So you shall put them on Aaron," this is regarding garments for temple service, "on Aaron your brother and on his sons with him. You shall anoint them, consecrate them, and sanctify them, that they may minister to me as priests." And the word that's used here, whereas the Old Testament, of course, is in Hebrew, and the word that we're talking about here to sanctify is hagiazo, the Septuagint would be the equivalent, so we can see that it's comparable use of the word, and so it has the idea of just simply being set apart for a particular purpose. Or Jeremiah 1:5 says, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I sanctified you. I ordained you a prophet to the nations." And again, here's the idea of being set apart, even from his mother's womb, that early on that he had been set apart for that purpose. And I always think about Jeremiah and what a great time he had. And the Lord knew from the beginning, "I've called you to this, and nobody's going to listen to you, but do it anyway." So when you're discouraged and you think, "Well, Lord, nothing is going the way I think it ought to go," you need to come back to say, "Well, am I being faithful to what the Lord called me to do? Even though nobody's listening, nothing is happening the way I think it ought to go." It also tells you that God has a plan when he sets us apart. And Jesus was a perfect example of someone who was sanctified, that is, set apart for a particular purpose, and he devoted himself completely and consistently to God's will for him, and we obviously want to emulate that because we are not quite as completely or consistently dedicated to the will of God as we would wish or recognize that we ought. And when you think about sanctification, the broader picture in John's gospel, it's always for a mission. It's toward a purpose. So being sanctified, as we think about it in the broad theological sense, means being set apart from sin unto God, but having a sense of purpose or service that is in view. It's not that we are set apart to set on a shelf like a trophy. We're set apart to serve, to accomplish what his will is. And the means of sanctification, particularly thinking about the experiential element of the place where we live, the means is the application of the word, taking the truth and applying it in life, in the context that we find ourselves in. And that's what we want to aim to do. And we think about Christ, he was referred to as the Word. You think about John 1:1, "In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God." John 1:14, "The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." John 14:6, Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." And then you think about the Spirit. The Spirit would help the disciples understand and apply the word that he was going to be coming upon them in a short time. And of course, John is writing after the fact, many years later, looking at and seeing how everything fits together. So John 16:13 says, "However, when he, the Spirit of truth, has come, he will guide you into all truth. For he will not speak on his own authority, but whatever he hears, he will speak, and he will tell you things to come." And so the word of truth is critical, and its It has a personal element because it applies to us in a personal context. As we make application of it, and it's propositional, it is outside of us. And so it is an absolute that's not just in us, it's out there, and so we can recognize that. And it is the ultimate source of truth for life. And we need to be aiming to see how we can apply that. And that's why truth is so important. And that's why it is such a mess today when truth is not recognized. It's not accepted. And that's your truth. That works for you. But is there an absolute truth that's outside of ourselves, that stands sort of above us, that applies to every person in every context of life? We recognize that, but the world around us does not. And we need to make sure we're taking that to heart. That it is absolute, and that it does make a difference, and that we are putting ourselves under that truth and submitting to it and living out the implications of it, so that we are living by the boundaries that the truth provides for us, and that we are following the direction that it gives for us as it relates to what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad, and what we ought to do and what we ought not to do. The context of personal behavior is the real world. That was brilliant, wasn't it? That's kind of like everybody knows that. But do we? I mean, we think about, we live in a messy world. I mean, the real world is the fallen world. We know, because we recognize what Scripture says is the problem, we know what that means. And we are under pressure from the world every day to be squeezed into its mold. And that's the translation that translations has of Romans chapter 12, verse 2, where we read in the New King James, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God." But it also has the idea of being squeezed into its mold, and we have to be careful. We need to rather take the truth and let it be transformational, so that it's changing me, that I can change the world for good, and that I'm taking it to heart. And that's what we need to do. Warren Wiersbe had this to say relating to this passage: "With the mind, we learn God's truth through the Word." That's with the mind, we learn God's truth through the Word. "With the heart, we love God's truth," including His Son, who is the truth. "With the will, we yield to the Spirit of truth, and we live God's truth day by day." And he says it takes all three for a balanced experience of sanctification. Do we have those elements? The mind, the heart, the will. Learning, loving, living that truth. That's what we want to be able to do. So then the last element. Behavioral expectations involve a practical, personal context. And just reviewing again verses 18 and 19. "As you sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world. And for their sakes, I sanctify myself, that they also may be sanctified by the truth." And that should tell us that you don't want to go into the world without the truth. You do not dare step out into this world without having a sense of what is right and wrong and true. We need to have a handle on that. Christ was given a very real and practical context for serving. Christ came into the real world. He left heaven's glory with all of the beauty and perfection that was there. He left that, took on human flesh, became one of us, and had to get his hands dirty and rub shoulders with unpleasant people, just like we do sometimes. and you think of all the different contexts that he could have been given, and he got one. And that was the context that he found himself in. And he had to work with whatever the Father had given him. And we have the same thing. And you think about, wow, you could have been born in any other place, country, in the world, in any other kind of particular context. But you were born where you were. And you were given that life, and you've got to deal with it. Just like Christ had to deal with what he was given, we've got to deal with what we've been given. And you can complain all you want to. But God says, I put you there for a reason. And we don't know what that reason is necessarily. Why was I born where I was born? Why were you born where you were born? And have the life that you have to live? Don't you wonder that sometimes? Or wonder why we have some of the challenges that we face? Because life is worked out in a very real context. And that's where we have the opportunity to live out and produce the sanctification that is called for. Because it's always worked out in a context. We have the truth in order to serve well in our context. Whatever it is, everybody's got their own. They're not the same. They weren't expected to be. And you may not like it. And I suspect maybe Jesus didn't like it when he found himself in the world where there was a lot of rejection. He came to his own, and his own knew him not. But sometimes when we focus on serving rather than the unpleasantries of whatever our context may be, we find we do like it because we have the benefit of experiencing the joy of serving Jesus. The only way we can faithfully serve in difficult circumstances is to know that we are in the truth. That we are doing what God has called us to do, that we are living consistently with the truth that he has given us, and can we, in fact, do that? And when we do so, when we recognize that, then we ought to be encouraged. We know that the world isn't going to accept us. But we know if we're living in the truth, if we're obeying God, following his will and his word, that we can have joy in the midst of whatever the circumstances are. But are we living out that truth? Being consistent with that? That's the issue. Are we willing to sacrifice for him in the light of all he's done for us? Even if it's in unpleasant circumstances. Because he came to unpleasant circumstances and he sacrificed his life for us.